Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. Digital and social media have upended the news industry. In this week's episode, we'll consider the rise of digital media and the ways to capture its benefits while mitigating its possible harm. Joining us is Jennifer Cobb. She's director of United for News. Eileen Donahue, executive director of the Global Digital Policy Incubator at Stanford University. Tristan Harris, co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology, and Gerald Ryle, director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. This conversation took place at our Global Philanthropy Forum, and Ray Suarez was our moderator. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray Suarez.
Digital media and social media have upended the news business, and that's no exaggeration. The tools reporters used to gather, distill, and transmit information are now widely available, and the skills to use them are widely distributed. Customers are now creators and rival the traditional business in access to eyeballs and access to eardrums. Along with this stunning democratization of the distribution of information has come the temptation to mislead and misinform, and a massive transfer of responsibility and a massive transfer of accountability from the conventional business to the end user herself and himself, as now we expect to a greater and greater degree the audience to sort out what to believe, what to discard, what to ignore, and what to click and immediately send on to all your friends. Eileen, why don't you get us started?
So first, let me say it's a pleasure to have this opportunity with all of you to talk about, as Ray said, probably the most unwieldy, complex, multi-layered conversation happening on the planet. It's also fascinating, but really urgent. My overarching frame for this conversation is our shared concern about the deteriorating health of the digital information ecosystem and its deleterious effects on democracy. This really goes to the issue of loss of trust in government, media, election outcomes, and the truth itself. Many different entry points, which you will get from this panel. My peculiar entry point for this conversation is the impact of digital technology on the enjoyment of human rights and on the empowerment of civil society. And in that particular vein, we've obviously seen a dramatic swing of the pendulum. The early days of the internet freedom movement, advocates were filled with very naive optimism, and I count myself among them, about the upside benefits of the internet for civil society and for the enjoyment of human rights. We assumed the disruptive effects of digital technology would be working for the good guys, that civil society would always be ahead of the curve and ahead of authoritarian governments. And we now today see a much darker picture. Obviously, authoritarian governments have caught up and are using digital technology for the opposite purposes, to control civil society, to control access to information and free expression. We also assumed the democratization of the means of distributing content would be net beneficial, and we failed to see that democratizing content comes with loss of quality. And that loss of quality of content ultimately can undermine the quality of discourse necessary to sustain democracy. Perhaps most disheartening was a realization that digital technology can be used very effectively by all kinds of malign actors around the world, and that digital tools for micro-targeting and amplification allow fabricated and divisive content to overtake authentic civic discourse. Sometimes this misinformation, disinformation travels much faster than the truth. So the bottom line is that we have to be very clear-eyed about the dual nature of technology, and I think our shared job is to find ways to capitalize on the upside benefits and protect against the downside. But there's one problem I would like to highlight as that I would say is the priority, and this we may differ here. I would put at the top of the list disinformation by malign actors intentionally manipulating civic discourse in democracies, and especially highlight foreign malign actors reaching across borders, pushing polarizing memes, intermingling in very bizarre ways with domestic hate groups, with the ultimate goal of undermining confidence in democratic processes and in democracy as a form of government. Democratic governments are obviously freaked out about this. Part of what's so frightening here is that free speech norms are being used to undermine free society. So they're not just messing with our discourse, they're kind of messing with our heads. And free speech is supposed to be the lifeblood of democracy. But now information is being weaponized against us. And this concept is really confounding and hard for democratic actors to get their heads around. National security folks were anticipating, to some extent, hack on critical infrastructure in election contexts, meaning machines, the voting machines. Maybe didn't even do that so well. But they did not anticipate a hack on the discourse. Last point would be, my biggest concern is actually the response to this threat. And I worry that democratic actors, democratic governments, are losing confidence in the feasibility of adhering to their own democratic values, and that in the name of protecting democracy, they will throw free expression and democratic values under the bus. And to me, this is a form of participating in the erosion of democracy and democratic governance, and almost participating unwittingly in the ultimate purpose of the information operations in the first place.
Tristan Harris, when you look at this set of challenges, what do you see?
This is such a big topic. So I just want to first introduce myself and my background a little bit. So I was a design ethicist at Google, which meant that I was studying how do you ethically manipulate 2 billion people's minds when they basically use screens. If you imagine there's an ant colony called humanity, where you have 2 billion human ants swarming around, and the first thing this ant colony does is, when they wake up in the morning, is look at their phone, you're basically steering the attentional lives of 2 billion people. So just to ground this for a moment, there's 2 billion people who use Facebook. That's about the number of notional followers of Christianity. There's 1.8 billion, as of this morning, that use YouTube. That's about the number of followers of Islam. And these products have more influence over people's daily thoughts and then therefore choices, because thoughts precede action, over 2 billion people's lives. So this is the largest invisible cultural political actor in the world, I would argue. And my thought when I was working on this at Google was, how do you ethically steer everything from, you know, how children relate to technology to elections to, right, to all of these things. And what we don't talk about is that these products are not neutral. In fact, there's a very dangerous goal that's driving the development of all of these products, which is the race for attention, because there's only so much attention out there. And the business model of, this is the elephant in the room of Facebook, YouTube, Snapchat, is to get people's attention. And so what they do is they find more and more tactics or techniques to throw at human beings' minds to be able to get it. So they throw Snapchat streaks on a teenager, and they hook kids into basically being looped together. YouTube basically highlights conspiracy theories because that's very engaging, and it was actually found that if you airdrop a human being into YouTube on a regular 9/11 news video, two videos later they're looking at 9/11 conspiracy theory videos, and YouTube drove 15 billion views of Alex Jones' InfoWars conspiracy theory videos. That was not people choosing to go to Alex Jones' conspiracies, that is actually the YouTube algorithm that is driving people towards that. So the real existential challenge here is that, you know, 50 to 100 engineers and designers who are the leaders at 3 or 4 companies are basically deciding what happens in the world. When I was a kid, I was a magician, and I basically studied that people's minds are very, very influenceable. We think in rooms like this that we're of course, we're the ones whose minds are not manipulatable, and we're only talking about those gullible people way over there who are influenced by Russia. That's not how it works. As a magician, you learn that every single mind is vulnerable to influence. It doesn't matter what language the audience member speaks. Doesn't matter whether they have a PhD. In fact, the more confident they are and the bigger the PhD they have, usually the more easily they are to manipulate. And so we've now hooked up this system of control, of large distributed sort of mind control, to 2 billion people's minds. And it's not accountable to the public interest. In fact, it's accountable only to one thing, which is what's good at getting attention. And it's usually automated. So in the case of YouTube, they don't actually have human beings deciding what gets streamed into people's heads. It's an algorithm. And the algorithm is just selecting what is the most engaging thing I can show you, whether engaging is true, whether engaging is outrage. Outrage is very engaging, so you have an entire society that's outraged. Conspiracy theories are engaging, so that you have an entire society that's running conspiracy. And in developing markets like Burma or Sri Lanka, you have very engaging fake news and other conspiracy sort of stuff that's driving genocides in those countries. The UN has called Facebook one of the largest contributors to genocide in the Rohingya conflict in Burma. So I see this as an existential threat in that you have companies and engineers who don't even speak the languages of the cultures and societies that they're impacting. There's no one at the, you know, the inmates are running the asylum, there's no one home. And these systems are having geopolitical, children's sort of emotional cognitive development consequences across every layer and fabric of society, and it needs to be held accountable. And I'll just say, we were involved in the Congress, we were briefing Congress and helping to arm them for the Russia investigations. We walked in the room over the summer in July, and I say this because in terms of reigning in their power, can we expect the government institutions to know what to do? And I walked in July into one of the ranking members of the Senate Intelligence Committee and found ourselves to be one of the principal sources unexpectedly of basically talking about how these platforms could be used for large influence campaigns. So there's an insane amount to talk about here, but the main takeaway point is that we need to hold these companies accountable.
Jennifer Cobb, when you listen to Tristan's presentation, I mean, for a news person, that's a dystopian vision of how information moves from person to person, how people make a coherent vision of the society that they live in and act as citizens. That's a recipe for the news business being more important and more needed than ever, but...
I completely agree, and I'm picking up on some of your themes, Tristan, thank you, and also Eileen. You know, misinformation, disinformation, propaganda, hate speech, these are actually nothing new in human history. We've had these around for a very long time. What is new is the transition to digital has really amplified these and sped them up. And your example of the Rohingya and in Sri Lanka, another important recent example is before the Kenyan elections this year, politicians were using social media to spread propaganda, which ended up leading to communal violence and violence against individuals and journalists. Again, that's an old technique in Kenya, but it was made new and more powerful with the digital technology. So, you know, we take these things very seriously. You know, but we also think that this is really a symptom of something much deeper happening. That what we're really looking at is probably the most significant disruption in human communication that the world has ever experienced. And the good news, and I do think there is a hopeful note here, disruption equals opportunity to make a change, to do something different. And we actually believe that if we can have a clear vision about where this can go and how it is can evolve, and it is evolving very rapidly, you know, a vision that really has media at the center of healthy societies and doing their job to hold people accountable and engage citizens and ultimately make sure that everyone everywhere has access to the information they need to make good decisions about their lives, that we can get into a very good place. But that is not going to happen on its own. That is going to require a lot of hard work from a lot of us. And I believe that this is the moment that we need to stand up. I mean, the gift of fake news, if you will, is it's brought this tension. We now have a tension on this issue. And what we can do is we've got to step out and bridge difference. We have to bridge across our silos, and we have to find new bedfellows to make this happen. And that's really the animating principle behind United for News. So United for News is a global multi-stakeholder coalition of industry, media, and NGOs working together to support and sustain media around the world, really to hang on to the good stuff in the middle of this transition. And we also have kind of a very special focus on local and community news because it's the most endangered, and also because it's a very precious resource. It's very hard to replace when it's gone. And people around the world report that the media they trust the most is their local media. So it's a really important part of the connective tissue of rebuilding these environments. So in pulling together United for News, we decided to approach a very kind of unique, I think, group of stakeholders. And this includes brands. We actually think there's a lot more that big brands can do to move this space. They have a lot of untapped power and resources. Mobile operators, absolutely key to this conversation. Mobile is how most people around the world get their news and information. Media, global and local, of course. Advertisers and ad tech, that's how the money flows around this system, and we need to be clear-eyed about that and have a good strategy for how we deal with that. And then, of course, NGOs and policymakers, because they, along with the media, really have a good sense of what's happening on the ground. And we all understand that media is very sensitive to culture, and we need to be aware of that in the markets where we operate. So over the last several months, and our approach, our key approach to the problems that we're trying to address is market-based initiatives that have the potential for systemic impact. So over the last several months, we've been consulting with our stakeholders, and we've come up with two key streams of initiatives that we're working on this year, and I'll just touch on them very briefly. The first is around trust, and the second is around sustainability. On the trust side, we're starting with inclusion, because we deeply believe that when media reflects the communities that it's covering, when people feel that their voices are heard, they trust that media. So inclusion is a key piece of trust. And on the inclusion work, we're starting with women and girls. And we're working with Bloomberg and Edelman to stand up a program that will significantly increase the number of women experts and sources cited in news around the world. This is work that Bloomberg has been pioneering for about 10 years, and we'll be working with them to replicate and amplify that. And this is really important because the global numbers around women cited in news is about 24%, and it's been stuck in the low 20s for decades. So we want to try and move the needle on that. On the sustainability side, we are standing up a very focused intervention into the world of programmatic advertising. Now, programmatic advertising, for those of you who don't follow this world, is really when algorithms automatically place ads onto websites. It's those annoying ads that follow you around the web. That's one way of thinking about it. It's actually much more than that, but that's what most people relate to. And what we're doing there, and this is a very important area because actually the global digital advertising market right now is $237 billion, and 67% of that is programmatic, and it's growing fast. This is how advertising is going to be done in the digital world going forward. So what we're doing is we're building a very specific targeted system that allows brands to send their ads directly to reputable media in the markets where they advertise. And we're also working to make sure that this system has a very tight supply chain so that more of every dollar from the brand spent ends up in the hands of the media. And this work is really inspired by one of our key partners on this initiative, Vodafone. So last June, Vodafone announced that it was going to take 100% of its global digital advertising spend and direct it only to reputable media in the markets where it advertises. This is an amazing act of leadership on their part, and we applaud them. They select their media based on what they call a predominant purpose test. They ask two key questions. The first is, does this organization produce any fake news, disinformation or propaganda? If it does, it's not on our list. Does this organization produce any hate speech against any ethnic group, gender, or minority? If it does, it's not on our list. So we'll be working alongside Vodafone and other partners to amplify and expand this, their approach, so that many, many brands can also participate in a similar system. And we think this has the potential for real systemic impact. Not only will it get more money to media, it will also starve some of the bad actors, the financially motivated ones, not necessarily the ones that Eileen was talking about, but that is a piece of the fake and hate world, is financial motivation. And finally, it has a really important downstream impact on media in the countries where it exists, because emerging media and other media will have an incentive to really up their game and professionalize so that they can participate in these markets, which will be increasingly important to their survival going forward.
Jennifer Cobb, thanks a lot. As I was preparing Gerald Ryle to do this panel, I was thinking about the best of times and the worst of times for investigative reporters. The tools available at their disposal are remarkable, and the things they can find out and the ways that they can use these new tools and the new arsenal of investigative journalists is phenomenal. And yet, it's one of the first casualties in a business where the business model is broken and it's considered a luxury that a lot of newsrooms can no longer afford. So, is it the best of times or the worst of times, or a little of both?
It's definitely a little of both. I mean, I think it's tremendously exciting times for journalism, because I think that we have an opportunity to remake journalism. But let me make this point. I think journalists are actually scared of technology. We've been scared of it for a while, mainly because we see that the internet and technology is breaking the business model that has sustained journalism for so long. But by ignoring technology, we're actually ignoring an opportunity. I will ask you one thing, but we really have to ask ourselves here is, what kind of media do we want? You know, we glamorize investigative reporting because of Watergate and because of all the president's men in the movie and all that. But the reality is, even at the height of the best of times, like, a very small percentage of what you're reading in your newspapers was actually investigative journalism. You know, it really didn't matter what you put in the paper. People were actually buying it for the ads. And TV stations basically became entertainment. And I think that allowed technology to step in and take over the way it has taken over. Because basically, you know, it was all about information, and we were no longer chasing information. We were no longer doing good investigative reporting, or mainly we weren't doing good journalism. So I think the reason why we're in trouble now is because we were doing our jobs very badly. So we now have to ask ourselves as journalists, you know, what kind of journalism should be done? And I think, you know, let me just tell you one way we're tackling it. I come from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. We're a little nonprofit based in Washington, D.C., and we've turned the way journalism is done, or investigative journalism done around the world, upside down. We're actually asking journalists to share information, to share stories. We're probably best known for the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers. These were investigations where we brought 400 journalists from more than 80 countries together to work in secret for a year based on leaked information from the offshore world. And when we published together, it was a storm around the world. We were able to get, we brought down two governments with the Panama Papers. We brought down the governments of Iceland and eventually Pakistan. We were able to get 150 inquiries around the world. We managed to, the governments recovered about $500 billion worth of money over the years. But by working together, we basically did better journalism. And by getting all these reporters from the best newsrooms in the world, like the New York Times and the BBC and the Guardian, working with reporters from small newsrooms in Ghana and other places, we're able to lift the whole concept of investigative reporting and, you know, bring it to a new era. We're also able to use technology in a way it hasn't been used before. You mentioned some tools. I mean, the things we can do with technology now is amazing. I mean, I've been doing this for 30 years, and you used to have to do things manually that would take weeks at a time that we can now do in seconds. But journalists haven't been using these tools, and we've been trying to use technology, marrying that technology with the techniques that journalists used to do, and in doing so, we're basically doing better journalism.
So as you can hear from our presenters, the challenges are interconnected and formidable, even if taken one at a time. From Tristan, the technological challenge of a sort of system that works with no human beings attending the machine, algorithms pushing content toward people's eyeballs without any human oversight to really sift whether this is a good or a bad thing for the public. From Eileen, the introduction of malign actors, people for whom the truth not only doesn't matter, it's actually a problem product. And that is very bad for democracy. It's very bad for the individual citizen. Jennifer Cobb, United for News, trying to find ways to defeat some of these new technological challenges that are working against the values that everybody on the panel has talked about. But there's also even a neurological level to this, where appealing, strong content that lacks ambivalence, lacks nuance, gets to some of the best real estate in your brain first, and even when you're presented with the truth afterwards, you will not let go of that first impression of something that factually is a lie. So the lies actually have a pretty good shot at colonizing our collective consciousness, because lies can be more exciting, more appealing than the boring old truth. I don't know, as a guy who's worked in the news business my whole life, I don't know how you operate happily in a world like that, where lies are more appealing than the truth, more strongly delivered, have a faster shot to people's bloodstreams and imaginations. Tristan?
Yep. If you think of lies and truth as two biological organisms, and the truth is restrained as an organism to only evolve within the space of what's true, and a lie to evolve, it's much less constrained. It's not less constrained, it's unconstrained. Lies have full access to mutate in whatever way happens to work. Truth cannot mutate beyond its actual form. In the disinformation world, we call this, if you can make it trend, you can make it true. The second I can make something trend, the media is caught in a double blind. Either it covers the rumor, and then it's confirming it, or it doesn't do it, and now it's a conspiracy, right? So Russia and all the other actors, and it's not just Russia, by the way, the whole point is, how do you make this stuff travel really quickly? And we've created a system by which the clock rate of these things spreads so rapidly, there's no control. You know, we have a 5-second delay on live TV for a reason. We don't have a 5-second or 10-minute delay on media or the kind of ethics. And I think what we're doing right now is going through a transition, just like we did with yellow journalism, where we had that period where it was just a race to the bottom, print whatever is you want to do. It created the Mexican-American War, or helped lead to that. And then it was after that period that we had the entire field of journalistic ethics, and we had to come to a whole reckoning, and the Pulitzer Prize was created to try to reward good journalism. I think I've been saying actually this for 5 years, we need a whole ethics of media design, and for the new public square. How do you ethically design the new public square and the clock rates that govern people's lives? And I think it's like cars. It's like, if you know, you can get seduced into speed and power if you just say, well, why don't we just keep letting cars go faster and faster and faster and faster? Why would we ever slow that down? And we realize it's because there's something ergonomic to how fast human beings can safely steer when they're in a control loop with a vehicle. And I think media is like a control loop, and we basically did not put in any constraints, and the move fast and break things philosophy of Facebook and other parts of Silicon Valley took over. And so there's never a concern about safety and ethics. And one of the other things I'll just lastly say, this is such a big topic, right now the companies are only doing reactive work. So they only tackle problems after something happens. And this should be more like NASA and safety engineering, where you have, or like an FDA, all the work should be proactive. There needs to be a slowing down of this system, and that can be done through regulation. That can be done in a lot of different ways. I'll say that there's four major levers that we've been using to try and shift the system and the actors that are here. The first is by creating kind of a cultural awakening. I was on 60 Minutes last year, helped raise awareness about this topic. Just ongoing media campaigns. Roger McNamee, who is Mark Zuckerberg's personal mentor, and I joined forces after 60 Minutes last year, and we've basically just been on a roadshow, you know, raising
raising awareness about it. We got Soros to do the speech at Davos, saying that social media is the largest threat to democracy. This kind of work really does make a difference, and that changes the effect for the second piece, which is that the employees at these companies are the ones who actually do the work, and if they're feeling demoralized because they know that their leadership is not taking the problem seriously, they start to leave. And you just saw that the two founders of WhatsApp just left Facebook, and other high-level people are leaving Facebook. That shunning effect is actually very powerful for changing behavior. The third is governments and congressional hearings and testimony hearings where you haul them to Congress. We didn't get the actual number of people affected by Russian propaganda, the 126 million, that's 90% of the US voting population. We didn't get that number out of the platforms until we hauled them to Congress. Literally, they had said it's only $100,000 in ads, that was the famous number, and a few million people, 1 million, 2 million people. And we actually had these, there's a lot of people who don't sleep, who work really hard, who break the terms of service and do all this data analysis late at night. And they said, no, it's tens of millions of people. And we had to haul them to Congress to get that number out of them. And the last one, sorry for going on, the last lever is inspiring an alternative. There's a different way to design all these things that's more humane. And people have to see that that's possible. You have to show them that alternative. Otherwise, you just live in this dystopia of what's wrong that exists today.
We've been hearing from a panel on how digital and social media have transformed the way we consume and view the news. After the break, the panel will consider ways to address the rise of fake news. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We've been discussing the impact of digital and social media on society, and joining us are Jennifer Cobb, she's director of United for News, Eileen Donahue, executive director of the Global Digital Policy Incubator at Stanford University, Tristan Harris, co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology, and Gerald Ryle, director of the International Consortium for Investigative Journalists. Moderating the program is Ray Suarez. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program that you may have missed, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, one word. And now back to our program.
This conversation has been international in tone and scope, but looking at the American context, we have a long tradition of not regulating content and not regulating content producers. And I've had people say to me when they hear my rant on the modern media, you are an elitist. You want a priesthood of content producers to still control the flow. People will sort it out. You're not giving enough people enough credit for being smart and being able to tell truth from lies. But I'm still wondering, if we've given the public a job it can actually do, Eileen and Jennifer, given them an assignment they can actually perform, in giving, opening up the spigots in this way, and saying, you guys sort it out.
I have two answers to that. And actually, I will start with a point that Jennifer made, which is that the problem of bad speech has always been with us. There's always been propaganda, misinformation, disinformation, hate speech. What's different now is that the speed, the scale, and the extraterritorial reach of digital technology has changed the game. And it is now the effects, the deleterious effects, are qualitatively different. It also means we need a new approach to solving the problem. I think part of what's showing up here is our old approach to thinking about regulating speech on a content basis isn't going to cut it. Our legal doctrine is just plain outdated, and I think the entire approach of using a content basis isn't going to work. In a democracy, there's this idea that there are limited, reasonable restrictions on speech, and that's a good thing. And we want to hold on to that norm. But we also have to solve this problem of bad stuff traveling faster than good stuff. Here, I would say the approach that's being now taken by some of the platforms to address this problem is not to approach it on a content basis, but to look at mechanisms of manipulation and inauthentic amplifiers. It's the vehicles for pushing this stuff that really will be part of the solution here. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll just add to that a little bit, actually, by taking us back out to the international context, because I think it is a helpful comparator. You know, I think that when all of this stuff hit us in 2016, we were utterly unprepared. We had no prior understanding of something like this happening, and we were like little unclothed newborns laying out in this vulnerable way. And I compare that to the time I've spent in Ukraine, which has been dealing with propaganda and misinformation and Russian influence for 25 years, 30 years. And people there are pretty savvy about it, actually. They've developed a certain healthy amount of immunity, and they can sort of tell. You know, if you ask school kids which one of these is real and which one of these is fake, they can generally tell you. It's not perfect. They run a lot of media literacy programs in the country, which is much needed, but they've been doing it for a long time. So I think there's an interesting, almost a research question here about looking at what are the sort of natural immunities and how do we build up immunity to these things. I don't know that we can just sort of lay down and say this is a we're just slaves to our cognitive processes and it'll never get any better. I do think that there are models out there that we can look to, and other countries I think can be illustrative in this.
Gerald, as I look at the work your members do around the world, it's often in some places where information is dangerous, it is dangerous work, and journalists are routinely killed around the world. But in some places, the leaders have finally figured out that you don't have to kill these people. That's a blunt instrument. You don't have to suppress the organs that they work for or shut them down, just flood the zone with alternative content that makes the blockbuster things that are often found out about the operations of government, the use of money, the mobbing up of leaderships with private interests, just flood the zone with other stuff and make the truth into an opinion, and you've neutralized journalists. You don't have to kill them. You just have to ignore them.
I think you're actually talking about America there at the moment. So, yeah. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's very, you know, it can be very dangerous work we're doing, but I've always thought that the best way to combat investigative reporting is actually the lawyers, because, you know, in many countries around the world, and certainly not here, I think this is one of the best jurisdictions to be in, which is why we're based here. The laws basically prevent you from telling the truth, because you can literally be sued for telling the truth. Even in a country where I spent most of my career, Australia, until quite recently, truth was not a defense in court. So pretty much every time you publish a story, you would end up being sued. And it got to the point where, you know, the media concentration in that country is very, very tight, because you need to have very deep pockets in order to be a publisher in the first place. But again, I go back to the point, we now have an opportunity to reinvent that and to change it. And I think since we're here at a philanthropy forum, I do think philanthropy has a huge part to play in this, because philanthropy allows new organizations to play in new fields and to experiment. And I think it's through experimentation that we're going to find a solution here. You know, journalism has got to reinvent itself and learn, you know, trust. People have got to trust the media again. They don't trust it anymore. And again, I think we're at fault ourselves, because we've for so long not been doing our jobs. We need to go back to that, get that trust, And again, I think through experimentation, you know, what we're doing here, you know, we're able to combat fake news by making sure that we have reporters from 107 media organizations all working together, all interpreting documents, you know, so by the time we publish, people cannot attack it as being untruthful. You know, even Vladimir Putin, who we basically accused of, you know, of funneling $20 billion through offshore companies, had to come out and say that everything we were doing was actually true. In fact, he said that, you know, he had a weird excuse for this. We basically had traced all the money back to his, to the godfather of his child, who turned out to be a cello player in an orchestra in Russia. And he said, oh, it was all for musical instruments, you know, but he couldn't actually deny the facts.
Jennifer, money is a big part of this. Gerald mentioned philanthropy, and certainly now there are not-for-profit models growing in the United States. But the news business runs on money in a lot of places in the world. Coming up with a not-for-profit in order to disseminate crucial information to a society doesn't seem to be a very promising model in a lot of places in the world. So can we marry the profit motive with the best ideals of what the news business is trying to accomplish?
Well, there is a lot of experimentation going on right now around business models around the world. I mean, there are grant-funded models, there are subscription models, there are membership models, there are ad-supported models, news organizations run events. There's a lot of things that people are playing with right now. And I think, you know, in all of that innovation and foment, there are some challenges. I mean, I think it's hard for news organizations to understand which models will suit them best. You know, the transition to a subscription model, for example, requires a massive user base before you can make that change, because only 5 to 10% of those people will actually sign up for your paywall. So you've got to kind of do the numbers on that. So, you know, in a lot of the markets where we are concerned, which are not necessarily in the developed world, but more in the middle and low-income markets, you know, that is really a challenge. Another challenge outside the U.S. is capture. You know, in many, many markets where we work, oligarchs buy, it's the first thing you do if you're an oligarch, you buy a TV station or a newspaper. I mean, it's really kind of a rite of passage, and that's true throughout the former Soviet world. It's true in South Asia. It's sort of an increasing thing that we're seeing. So, you know, within all of those business models, I kind of come back to, you know, the one of the reasons I think we're at United for News, we're really focused on the advertising model, is that, oddly enough, when you think about it, advertising through a programmatic system is actually pretty democratic. I mean, if you curate, which is what we're planning to do, curate the inventory, basically curate the recipients, so you're protecting quality in terms of where the money can flow, once it's in there and it flows to all of them equally. So it's actually, everything has a form of capture. Grant funding has a form of capturing, and everything has its challenges, but there's something about that I think that we should be revisiting and rethinking in terms of a potential support for media.
I was going to say, the other elephant in the room here is that Google and Facebook have basically controlled the customer acquisition cost for all media publishers. So if I'm Google or Facebook, I can turn down one publisher and I can turn up another, and I do that accidentally every time I make a change in the algorithm. And so really it does come down to Google and Facebook, because they are responsible for like 50% together of the traffic to these publications. And there's nothing holding them accountable. And so I think actually, you know, frankly, we've given the tech industry a free pass on regulation. And I think the tech industry actually we need to redistribute those profits from the attention grabbing companies, which have basically taken all the attention as consumers want to get to news, but they profit from it and then hold the spigot off on all the small publishers. And it frankly, you know, harmed them. And I think that, you know, you can actually summarize what's happened with the tech industry is we've given the tech sector a free pass on regulation, like writ large, because we want to innovate, we want the economy to grow, don't regulate them at all. But then Mark Andreessen's insight is that technology eats up every other industry because technology is more efficient. If I used to run it with a bunch of human beings doing some stuff, that would be much slower than letting technology do it. So these new tech companies form, they make something more efficient, whether it's advertising or media. And the problem is they take the regulated industry and then they deregulate it.
Well, Tristan, let me jump in there, because I'm wondering whether that mailed fist in a velvet glove of the threat of regulation down the road helps inject a little bit of accountability into this conversation. Because until now, as you point out, the big players have said, oh, you know, we don't produce content. We're a neutral platform that other people post on, so we're not responsible for anything that happens there. I think that pose has been punctured a little bit by recent testimony on Capitol Hill, but there's also starting to be mumbling about this not working out for people, this system as it is, this almost technological determinism this is not untouched by human hands. That may be looking a little weak, too.
I mean, they've been hiding behind this we're a neutral tool thing for a long time. And it's like a magician. Like, I'm looking at you and I'm saying, now, so if you use Facebook, you're thinking, what shows up in your newsfeed? Well, if I'm Facebook, I'm telling you, you're telling me I'm responsible? I'm Facebook, I'm responsible? No. You picked the friends that you followed. You picked the articles that showed up in your newsfeed. You click which articles you like, so therefore, aren't you responsible for those choices? It's very persuasive, isn't it? Like a magician. Now, you chose whether it was a red card or a black card, did you not? You chose whether it was which face card it was, a king or a queen, did you not? And so you made that choice totally freely, did you not? And of course, I manipulated your choice way upstream. Because of the thousands of things, if you follow the same 100 people on Facebook, I do and she does, you would think that we're following the same 100 people, we should have the same newsfeed. But of course, that's not how it works. Because in those hundreds of people, there's thousands of potential things to show you. And of those, they select the things that are going to get the most clicks and most shares. So we're going to get the outrage out, and it's going to be different outrage for both of us. Because I'm outraged about different things than she is. And so the companies really are, they'll say, you don't want us to be the arbiters of truth. They invoke the Orwellian metaphors. You don't want us to be the ones who decide. But they already are, because they're already the ministry of attention. If you control attention, there's only so much, then you control what people believe is true or not, because you're already controlling which journalists people reach or don't, and which local publications they reach. And that's why it really comes down to controlling their power.
The morning after the Brexit vote in Britain, a British journalist was looking through his social media feeds and said, we've just had an election where half the country decided they want out of the European Union, and I couldn't find a single one on social media. I live in this country, and I couldn't find a single posting from one of my fellow citizens because the algorithm is so powerful, it was sending me what it thought I wanted to see, but I wanted to see the postings of people who don't agree with me, and I couldn't find them. He said, I was in a 50-50 country where it looked like everybody was upset, as I was, that we were leaving the European Union. The algorithm, I think, because it's so seamless, because it's so transparent, because it's so automatic, we forget about it sometimes. My students at Amherst were trying to research some of the topics that have been most widely distorted by the operation of social media, and they had to, in effect, invent new selves in order to find information that was contrary to their own understood belief systems when they were trying to use online tools to research these things. Tremendously potent. Eileen, you wanted to say?
Sure. There's so many rich themes here. Your starting place was about the threat of regulation, changing the approach of the platforms. I think that's very real, but I think we need to be cautious here because there is a danger of not fully understanding the dynamics at play by the governing actors who are proposing regulation, and there can be negative unintended consequences. You brought up Mark Andreessen. You know, he had that piece 2011 about software eating the world, and as you said, it eating up whole swaths of the economy and this disruptive effect, obviously disruption on media. I think there has been a complete disruption of our governing concepts. And that's what's going on here. The debate we now have is how to categorize these platforms. Are they just pipes, neutral platforms for the flow of information? Are they more akin to editors? I think we need a new category. I don't think that binary framing is right. There's something else going on here. I would say that platforms are functioning almost as de facto sovereigns, at least with respect to free expression on their platforms. They control the parameters of free speech through terms of service, community guidelines, algorithms. I completely agree with that. Yet, I would say that going right to being arbiters of truth, I would not go there. I think they are now embracing the reality that they are arbiters of quality, but that is not exactly the same as being an arbiter of truth. And I think this is the same as we've had in society generally. We don't want the government to be the thought police or the arbiter, the ministry of truth. And same thing for the platforms. So I caution people there. There's a lot of nuance.
Gerald, what do you have to be worried about?
Well, I'd be very worried about censorship generally, because as we've found around the world, when you start censoring information, then you really are controlling the population. And I just think that, you know, Brexit moments can have their upsides, and I'm very positive about everything, but like, it takes a crisis to find a solution, and I think you need to go through what you're going through now in the US. The British need to go through Brexit to realize that they actually need to deal with this problem, and if they don't deal with it, then it's going to get worse. You know, I would also, like, you know, again, over and over again, ask, what is quality? What are we talking about here? Let's just re-ask that question from the beginning.
A little more on that. Do we have assumptions, embedded assumptions about what quality is in a room like this that guide this conversation? Are we being broad enough about the way that word lands in a lot of different precincts in this country?
Look, I think so. I think, you know, we all come from, well, a lot of people here come from a certain understanding of what relevance is about. And we don't realize that there are different strands of society and they need different things. And I think it takes a crisis when you actually realize that your way of thinking isn't the way everyone else is thinking to make you ask, you know, again, that big question, what is relevant? What should we have? What media do we need going forward?
In the time we have left, I'd like to hear from all of you, both your final thoughts, because people were poised with their mics and ready to go, but also more broadly, some suggestions on how we save what's great about what's happening now without discouraging the bubbling up fabulous new content creators, the voices that couldn't be heard on the old steep on-ramp, while at the same time discouraging or even chasing out bad actors. How do we strike that balance and do it in a way that's good and healthy for the civic body?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the ultimate goal are diverse and pluralistic media environments, and that is going to mean something different in every country based on its culture, its politics, and its needs. And I think the thing that we forget in the conversation about technology, which I completely agree with what Tristan has been saying, is that there are a lot of smart human beings in all of these markets who understand what's going on. They are embedded deeply, they understand their media environment, and we are not doing enough to leverage them and their voices and their experience into this conversation. Especially in this country, we get very lost in the hegemony of the big platforms, and it is a serious, serious problem, but I do think we can start to build other types of networks and resources and insight. And it really is going to be critical, particularly at this point when the platforms are under so much pressure to do something different. I mean, they really are, I think, very confused about how to solve this problem, as are we all. But, you know, like our partners in Myanmar, our partners in Ukraine, our partners in Sri Lanka, you know, they would love to have a mechanism to be able to speak back and speak up and address their concerns to some of these platforms, and they feel completely powerless. So I do think there's more we can do at the grassroots, bottom-up level. I mean, these systems are totally top-down, and start to try and build things outside of the algorithms and bring human beings back into the conversation. And that's very much our approach at United for News as well.
Gerald Ryle?
I think we need to basically develop better technology to allow journalists to deal with large information sets. I mean, we're in an era of information. We found with the Panama Papers and Paradise Papers, like they were the biggest data sets in history that had been leaked. So whistleblowers are able to gather information on a scale that's never thought possible before. And I think the challenge for journalists now is to disseminate that information and understand that information. But they also, we also face a new threat because technology basically allows you to trace whistleblowers in a way never thought possible before, too. So I think the challenge is we should put money into technology that allows journalists to get this information safely and for us to be able to communicate with people safely. Because I do think, you know, one thing I've learned through 30 years of reporting is that your best sources are actually your audience. And there's always somebody in that audience who cares enough about what they're seeing to be able to give it to the journalist. And of course, if it's relevant and if it's in public interest, then the journalist will publish that and the public will like it. That's what we should be doing.
And we'll end where we began with Eileen Donahue.
So obviously this is kind of an all hands on deck moment, and I think there is a role for everybody, but I would emphasize the role of citizens and civil society, and I would say we all need to invest much more in media literacy, which sounds sort of boring and ineffective, but we have not come close to scratching the surface of what's needed there. And I think it has to have an emotional component where we generate this sense of don't be duped. Similarly, digital security for citizens, you know, you think about hacking and doxing has played a role in a lot of this undermining of democracy. Don't be hacked. And on norms on civic discourse, I would say don't be mean. You know, we need to have a new conversation there. On the platforms and the private sector, I think obviously there's been a shift and there needs to be more an internalization of a sense of accountability to the public, to users, and to democracy. On the conversation of how censorship is happening because of flooding the zone, there are new forms of censorship happening, and I think that we need new categories for thinking about censorship that are not content-based. These are mechanisms of manipulation. The problem isn't the content. It is how we're being manipulated in society. Media, I would say, has to build a business model based on trust, and you have to win on that basis. And a new ethos against or on your reporting on doxed information. And last on governments, I would say tread carefully and don't throw your own values under the bus in the name of protecting democracy.
You've been listening to an edition of World Affairs that comes from the Global Philanthropy Forum. You heard Eileen Donahoe, who is the executive director of the Global Digital Policy Incubator at Stanford University, Tristan Harris, the co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology, Jennifer Cobb of United for News, and Gerald Ryle from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. I'm Ray Suarez. You've been listening to World Affairs. Thanks a lot. Good to have you all with us.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Jennifer Cobb. She's director of United for News. Eileen Donahue, who's executive director of the Global Digital Policy Incubator at Stanford University. Tristan Harris, co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology, and Gerald Ryle, director of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. This program was moderated by Ray Suarez. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program that you may have missed, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, one word. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.